This is audio in MP3 of Miglane, the Ethership Mystery and its Solution. From more than 60 years back. Text to this can be downloaded on the net. Search the title. This was found on vahaysdewys.net in PDF. Preface. No attempt is made in the following pages to prove the objective and factual existence of the flying discs and other strange sky craft, since on this point there is no longer any doubt. On account of the great variety in shape, color and behavior of these flying objects, a generic name is needed. The term ether ships or ether craft has been adopted, since it indicates the true nature and origin of all these diversified phenomena. Borderland Sciences Research Associates do not constitute or represent any cult, organization or special interest. They are free, lance investigators of phenomena with which official science, for one reason or another, does not deal. The material contained in this booklet is believed to be of great importance and is presented as a public service, and the associates welcome the cooperation of persons sympathetic with their attitude and objectives. San Diego, December 1957. The Ethership Mystery and ITS Solution, 1. The series of aerial phenomena which are here described under the term etherships, flying saucers, first attracted public attention in the fall of 1946. It was by no means the first appearance of these craft in the skies of our planet, but very few persons were aware of this fact, and the public as a whole at first refused to credit the reports at all. The newspapers, the radio, and many psychologists and scientific workers joined in discrediting the alleged facts, and in attributing them to delusion or deliberate falsifying. Nevertheless, the evidence continued to accumulate, with most circumstantial and detailed reports from competent observers, until finally a systemic investigation was undertaken by the United States Air Force. The outcome of this was indeed curious, since after some 2 years of study of the phenomena, the Air Force has recently announced officially that there is no genuine and factual basis for the reports. The explanation for this will doubtless become clear at some future time. The public, however, shows no sign of accepting this remarkable pronouncement. New reports of the strange sky visitors appear almost daily, and their existence is definitely established. The purpose of these pages, therefore, is not to argue the case for the existence of the discs or saucers, since data would run to some hundreds of pages, but rather to present as simply as possible the true nature and meaning of the phenomena. It seems to us important, and in the nature of a public duty, that this be done. There is already apprehension in the minds of many, and if, as we expect, many more striking craft are attributed to some foreign and unfriendly government, hostility and fear might develop, and if they are believed to come from some other planet of our solar system, unreasoning and superstitious fear is to be reckoned with, perhaps with a considerable degree of social disintegration. This latter hypothesis, in fact, is already being advanced in all seriousness, though for no better reason than that no other origin seems conceivable, yet there is another possible source, and we are convinced the true source, for these strange craft, and the time has come when this explanation must be made available to everyone, in the simplest terms possible. Unfortunately, not everyone will find the explanation easily understandable. It cannot be disposed of by a word of one or two syllables only, such as Mars, Venus, or even Russia, but requires a little sustained attention and mental effort. On the other hand, the interest of most of our readers will not be in the physics and the speculative science involved, but in a few eminently practical questions, such as, 1. What are the flying discs? 2. Where do they come from? 3. Who operates them? 4. Why do they come into our skies? 5. Are they friendly, or are they dangerous? An answer to these questions, if it can be given, will probably satisfy the active curiosity of most readers. To those of a more reflective mind, and to the scientist, philosopher and non-dogmatic religionist, such answers, baldly put, will be only a shadowy beginning or perhaps too fantastic to reckon with at all. But for our present purposes we shall neglect these tough, minded and critical folk, and answer our own questions in a more categorical way. What are the flying discs? First, let us say what they are not. They are not delusions, fantasy, or lies. They are not constructed by any foreign government, or by our own. They do not come from the depths of the sea, though some of them may enter the sea at times. They do not come from the polar regions, or from Tibet or Java, though it is conceivable that some temporary base on our Earth may be utilized. They are not constructions of the Atlanteans or other ancient peoples, preserved in caverns against the coming day of need. We mention these hypotheses because they have all been seriously advanced. Our categorical denial should really be read this way: we have no evidence that any of these explanations is correct, and none of them coincide with what we believe to be the correct facts. But we offer the first word and not the last in this matter. New data may appear at any time. To these denials, let us add: the etheric craft, the discs, do not come from any other planet, visible astronomical body only, of our solar system, or from any other heavenly body known to us. So far as a popular explanation exists, this planetary one is most in favor. The reason is obvious, and the reasoning goes this way: the discs are not made on this Earth, yet they are real and not illusionary, therefore they must be made on some other planet, presumably Mars or Venus, since these are the nearest. This reasoning, however, suffers from what logicians call an omitted middle, or a third somewhat, an alternative which is overlooked. "Can you build a better mousetrap?" asks a magazine writer recently, clearly distrusting his own planetary theory yet unable to think of anything else. We reply promptly: "We certainly can. The simplest description of this mousetrap is our present objective, and if your patience permits, we shall try to make the whole concept reasonably clear, though not necessarily acceptable to your personal thinking, of course. What are the discs and where do they come from?" We shall have to combine the questions and answers. They come from the region of existence called the etheric plants, or etheric level, and by us with the name Etheria. Who operates them? The etheric people, the Etherians. Are they friendly, or hostile, or dangerous? Neither friendly nor hostile on the whole, but mainly indifferent towards us. But they are not indifferent if we attack them, or pursue and annoy them, or make them uncomfortable, apparently, by our atom bombs, the release of atomic or nuclear energies. Further on this point, it is highly likely, not provable, that our Air Force has already lost more than one ship through their attempted interference with these etheric craft. It is believed and is probable that they are surrounded by a powerful magnetic field, or some force corresponding to it, which easily disintegrates our own aircraft. It is likely that the release of atomic energies is felt on the etheric levels with some discomfiture. It is possible, though wholly conjectural, that they might intervene to prevent a world war with atomic weapons, and especially with such a weapon as the proposed hydrogen bomb. But then, why do they come into our skies at all? Two reasons can be suggested, or two aspects of the same reason. These etheric craft have appeared at intervals throughout history, sometimes without a definite correlation with Earth events, but always, it is said, when a civilization or culture had reached its peak and was entering upon a period of decline and fall. Their purpose was simply to observe and study the conditions and state of humanity, for their own information and their historical archives. They have also appeared prior to terrestrial convulsions, such as volcanic eruptions and earthquakes. In the present instance, it is likely that both reasons exist. The social and political state of the world is indeed perilous. Our weapons have become a menace to the Etherians themselves, and it is said that seismic disturbances are impending. Over the Pacific slope, for example, the flight of ether ships has followed the magnetic meridians, north and south. It is said that the Etherians are doing this in order to observe the formation of the etheric vortexes which presage an earthquake. They are charting this area, and also the whole of the Earth's surface, for the same general purpose of scientific study. Now, Whatever you think of the ideas and explanations here advanced, remember that there is nothing vague and uncertain about the presence of these strange craft, or about their remarkable speed and power and complete superiority in the air. This is an intensely practical matter, and how far reaching it may be, no one can say. This means that our personal attitude is also a matter of practical concern. Let us remember that the Aetherians are not ill disposed toward us, that we should not fear them, should never attack them. Further phenomena are almost certain to occur and may be of the most remarkable kind. Panic and superstitious fear may seize upon the masses. It may happen that a considerable measure of responsibility will fall upon those us who have some measure of understanding of what is taking place. Heretofore the Aetherians have withdrawn quietly when their mission was completed. Men thought of them as gods or angels, or spirits of the air or demons, embodied them in folklore and mythology, and forgot them little by little. So it may be, this time. They may withdraw from our skies, and in a few months men will have almost forgotten them. But there are reasons which cannot be elaborated here, for believing events may take another and more striking course. Neither your will nor mine can stay these events, but fear, fanaticism and panic may work incalculable woe. Panic is contagious, it engulfs one like an enormous wave, and at the moment we fancy ourselves cool, calm and superior of mind, are dragged under by it. No other considerations would lead us to write these pages, which will for the most part be read with derision or be wholly disregarded. Where is Aetheria? One matter of immediate practical interest, the inevitable question. Where is Aetheria? If you think where is an easy question, go put it to the philosophers, but some answer must be made, so here is a reply in a few lines, to be elaborated perhaps on subsequent pages. Aetheria is here, if we know what here means, along, side, inside, outside of our world. Because our world, that is, the so-called dense matter of the objects in our world, is a rarefaction. It is spaced out like a VST net, a net with enormous meshes. Imagine, if you will, a net of wire with meshes a mile wide. Would not wind and water flow through that net as if it did not exist? A little friction, very, very little, on the strands of those meshes we live. That is the so-called dense matter of our world. We look out across the mesh and do not see anything in it, or hear or feel anything in it, and so call it empty space. Meaningless words in the abysses of folly. We see, hear, feel the other strands of the mesh, and call our world solid, firm and material. Call it a real and substantial thing. But the spaces of the mesh are 1,000 and 10,000 times greater than the substance of the strands. What is in these spaces of the mesh of our matter? Space. Space is not nothing. Space is stuff, is matter. What kind of matter? The matter which makes the ethers. More dense, not less, but more dense by far than the rarefactions of our world. The matter of the etheric world. Inside the molecules, inside the atoms, still other atoms inside of those, or 10,000 Chinese eggs each inside of another. If you think that this is imagination, or that there is no room for these interpenetrating universes, ask the physicist and the mathematician. They will tell you there is nothing in the omniverse but room, and room, again, is space, is stuff, is basic world stuff, mind stuff, life stuff, and there is no emptiness anywhere, and that is why Aetheria is here. But it is also everywhere. All heavenly bodies have an etheric realm. A few lines more and we shall have done with the more practical and pressing aspects of our subject. The etheric ships, as everyone knows, are of many types, not all of them discs by any means. Some are long and cigar-shaped, many are shaped like balloons or dirigibles, some have wings or wing-like attachments. Many of them appear to change shape while in the air. Their color varies also and has also been seen to change. Some of them resemble fire, balls, others are accompanied or followed by smoke, vapor, and luminous appearances. Some are translucent, or seem to glow from within. They travel at all speeds, from zero, stationary, to thousands of miles an hour. They also vary widely in size, from a few feet or yards in diameter to nearly incredible dimensions. We have reports considered trustworthy of at least one craft 10 miles in length. They have a curious way of disappearing suddenly when in plain sight, and also of rapidly dwindling in size without withdrawing in distance. It is well to bear all these items in mind, since any single explanation must obviously cover all of them. It is not enough to invent some theory for the disc ships alone and then imagine what that the whole matter is accounted for. Now, under the etheric explanation which we are presenting here, our understanding is briefly this: etheric explanation of flying saucers. All of the types of craft just mentioned come from the same source. All are constructed by etherians. Their variety arises from the fact that many of them are experimental, and that different types of them serve different technical purposes. These craft are built in matter of the etheric plane and are imperceptible to us, since they exist in what we call empty space. They enter our plane or our level of perception by a process of materialization. The extremely dense matter which fills in the pattern of etheric stresses is replaced by matter of the kind that is visible to us, or better, its vibration rate is lowered until it becomes visible. A little like slowing down a very fast fan until one can see its blades. This is closely similar to what happens in the phenomenon aura portation, where objects, of any kind or size, are miraculously transported into and out of sealed rooms, sealed containers and the like. Many people, and most scientists, take no stock in this alleged phenomenon, but it is well attested and cannot be surrendered on that account. Neither the pattern nor the molecular filling is destroyed, the object becomes invisible because the atomic motion is speed up, and it can pass through other matter, a wall. For example, because of this same fact. This is equivalent to an increase in density when an object on our place is being apported from one place to another. To an etherian, an object materializing on our plane would dematerialize on his. To us it materializes in our field of perception, and dematerializes when it returns to its etheric state. If we understand this, we are on the way toward accounting for many odd items of behavior, such as have been mentioned above. It is probably well known by this time, that several of these ether ships have fallen, and their contents carefully studied, although with utmost secrecy. We cannot enter here upon this part of, which has been printed in other BSRA publications. We wish to refer only to the little people, dwarfs about 30 inches in height, whose bodies were found within the discs. We have reason to believe that the etherians, who must operate on their bodies just as they do on the etheric substance of the disc in order to accompany them, choose to materialize in small forms, simply for the convenience of operation and flight. This, like everything else set forth here, is according to our best knowledge and belief of this writing. We repeat, that we are offering the first words and not the last on this extraordinary problem. The propulsion of the etherian craft is beyond the present concepts of our science, yet we have a good clue to its nature, and shall comment on it on a later page. There is no motor, propeller or other mechanism inside the fallen discs. So far as we have been able to learn, we must add the extraordinary fact, that under certain conditions, or at certain states of materialization, or at certain altitudes and pressures, the substance of the ether ships is jelly, like and actually does change in shape and apparent size. The outer skin of the fallen discs, however, is harder than steel, and of unidentified substance. It is our information that certain types of the ether ships are and have long been used for interplanetary travel. Those who persist in the belief that they come from visible planets of our system, will eventually seize upon this as a confirmatory fact. But the ether ships do not originate on visible planets, as we have said. Interplanetary travel is simply one of their innumerable uses, and this fact should not mislead us. The craft are made in etheria, and etheria is in and around all visible objects. It is also the home and motherland of our plane. All the objects we see about us derive from that source, and our own bodies also. We ourselves are etherians by ancestry and descent, for Etheria is the home of the human race. That we should be so grossly ignorant of it is strange indeed. Some will understand. It is this ignorance, and the kind of understandable intolerance which must accompany it, which makes it so difficult, almost impossible to explain this matter to many readers, not excluding the average scientific worker, the professional man, and the so-called intellectuals generally. The obscurantist effects of the academic and professional background are in fact well known, except to those afflicted by them. There are, however, some millions of people, less victimized by the hypnotic dreams of our pseudo-culture, who will well understand what we are trying to set down. The next chapter in the story of European culture will be the story of the light from the other side. Egon Friedel wrote this at the end of Volume 2 of his Cultural History of Europe. It has been the practice of the present writer, when attempting to lecture on this subject, to allow a brief intermission at this point before entering on even more fantastic excursions. At this time the more outraged hearers were free to withdraw, noisy sleepers could be admonished, and if the entire audience, often as many as 20 people, chose to depart en masse, a refund of 1/3 the admission money was usually sufficient to ensure a peaceful exit. The advantages of this plan were so great that it has here been imported into written composition also, the intermission taking place at the beginning of section 2. 2. Having now disposed of the more urgent issues of this subject and following the intermission, it seems best to refer again to the subject of this cloud, cuckoo, land of Etheria, and the possibility, probability, even the necessity for its existence. We refer to it under this mythological title because most people, though they believe in heaven on Sundays and in hell when misfortune pursues them, are quite unable to believe that Etheria, being invisible, unheard and untouchable, has any reality about it at all. We do not blame them particularly, at least not as much as we do some of our speculative physicists who are already up to their necks in Oriental metaphysics, and hence should be reasonably open-minded. Yet it may be possible to invest the idea with a certain sweet reasonableness for a time, even though our indomitable common, non-sense rejects it soon afterward. If there are colors we cannot see, sound we cannot hear, and dense and solid bodies which we cannot discover by touch, it is certainly not too difficult to conceive of a world which, though possessing sounds, colors and material objects, is yet imperceptible to us. It would be as unknown to us, by direct perception, as a man is to an ant, or a bird to a beetle. And if any or beetle, or a fish in its element could be questioned and could make a reply, they would probably be deeply skeptical about the existence of men and birds, unseen and unseeable entities alleged to be living right along, side of them in the same world. This is, obviously, a matter of what is called planes of consciousness or awareness, and not really in the same world at all. The ant world is the nest or hill. The fish world is a limited area of sea, and though it happens that man can peer in on both of them, they have no way of discovering him. At this point the fruitful principles of analogy suggest, that possibly there are invisible beings who can peer in on man also. He may be the crux of creation, or cross of affliction of it, but is not necessarily its crown. And though reputed to be a little lower than the Angles, this earth manifestation of him at least may be but little higher than a caterpillar, in the eyes of unknown but observable intelligences. This somewhat despiteful guess, however, is a little by the way. We intended to return to our high school physics, make me a child again just for tonight, with reference to our perception of sound and color. Of course, if you define sound as sensation, as audibility, then by definition there are no sounds you cannot hear. If you define color as seeing, as visual perception, then by definition there are no colors you cannot see. But the physicist knows that colors are distinguished from each other by their wavelengths, and the length of the waves has been measured. Red, for example, has a wavelength of 0.00007594. While violet, at the other end of the visible spectrum, is 0.00003968. All the other colors come in between with decreasing values. But that does not mean the series or scale of color is exhausted. The tabulation of wavelengths goes right along below the red and above the violet. It is only our ability to see them which runs out on us. Using the word color in this very correct and logical sense, it is plain that an object may have a color which we cannot see, and will therefore be invisible to us. The situation with regard to sound is of course analogous. Some people hear sounds which others cannot. Many savages and nearly all animals have an almost miraculous acuity of hearing, and the existence of inaudible sound vibrations is a commonplace of science. A whole new science of ultrasonics is now fast developing. The point is too obvious to spend time upon. There are sounds about us which we can't hear, just as there are colors we can't see. There may be, then, according to common sense and common science, a world of sound and of color, and even of colored objects all about us, yet wholly unperceived by us. All this, as we promised you, is sweetly reasonable. But now we come to the sticker. Everyone knows, you say, that there are waves, frequencies, vibrations of sound and light which we cannot sense. But what about this matter of touch, of tangibility? We do not see or hear the cat on the rug, or the antique rocking chair with its 100 arms when we go groping and fumbling in the dark, but we soon discover them in another way. Soundless and colorless objects are at least tangible, and if there is a world, full of them all about us, why do we not feel them, make contact with them, discover them by instruments? If there is such a world, you say, it must be vaporous like air or gas, or emanations, radiations or rays. The objection is natural, legitimate and answerable, but to begin, we must make the difficulty seem worse by affirming that this unseeable and unhearable world is composed of matter which, far from being like vapor or gas, is 1,000 times more dense, more solid, real and material than the objects of our own plane. There is such a thing as matter, substance, stuff which is too dense to touch. We were talking, a few lines back, about the spectrum of color and sound. We must now consider that by analogy at least there should be a spectrum of touch or of tangibility, also. There really is such a spectrum, and the upper limit of it is familiar to everyone. When solid matter is vaporized, we cannot touch it or usually see it, nor can we feel the presence of most rays, radiations and emanations. The difficulty, then, is about the lower end of this spectrum. We are accustomed to thinking of very dense matter, such as a stone or brick or lead, as being real and tangible, and of fluffy, light, floating things as approaching an intangible condition, yet here we are affirming that stuff which is far more dense than lead or stone cannot be touched at all, just for that very reason. Either we are talking nonsense or our habitual common sense view of the world is very naive. To get straightened out on this, we shall have to ask ourselves a few questions. Compressed to invisibility. Let us suppose we have before us two small cubes, one of cork and the other of lead and each the same size, 1 inch in each direction. The lead cube weighs more, the pull or push of gravity on it is greater than on the cork, and has more mass, which refers to the quantity of matter in it, but it has the same overall volume as the other cube. Now imagine that we can exert a very powerful pressure on all sides at once, of this lead cube, so that it is compressed. That means that the particles of lead are forced a little closer together. Imagine this pressure continued and increased until the cube becomes 1/2 inch, 1/4 inch, or 1/16 inch in dimensions. Imagine it decreased to a pin, point size, and then to a point where it becomes microscopic, invisible. All of the original cube is there, all of its mass and weight, only the volume has changed. Suppose this ultra microscopic cube is hurled against the cube of cork. Will the latter stop it? This enormously heavy and extremely small particle will pass through the loose structure of the cork as if it were not there at all. The cubic inch of lead, by virtue of becoming thousands of times more dense than the cork, by the process of reducing its volume, penetrates the lesser density with ease. What else has happened inside the cube of lead as it was compressed? Leaving aside all the books full of fact and theories about the atom, Let us concentrate on the single fact that every constituent particle of the lead is believed to be in motion.